This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
G'day, you are tuned to RTRFM 92.1, and this is the Indie Media Show, and we are broadcasting from the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people, and I'd like to offer my respects to them and their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Huge ups to Jeff and the On The Record crew for another fantastic edition of the show. They are back. Jeff's doing silly little dances in the studio next door. Oh, such a lovely presence, Jeff. He'll be back next Monday, and you've got On The Record every day, Monday to Thursday, 9 to 11. G'day, my name is Joni Boyd, and I'm here with Kelly. G'day, Kelly, how's it going?
Hello, how are you?
I am good, actually. I'm feeling very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready for some political news, some news from, you know, the underground and the corners of the internet and, activist spaces and stuff like that. That's the kind of thing we do here on Indie Media.
What more would you want on a Monday morning?
Absolutely. Get your dose of news that you probably wouldn't hear elsewhere. Good to be back in the studio. We haven't been in the studio together for ages.
I know, it's been such a long time. Well, I just haven't been in the studio for ages.
Yeah, yeah. And then, why not?
Wait, I don't know. I've been dumb. Get in there.
It's good vibes in the studio. Starting to miss some Brahma, Ray's dog that he brings in. Ray is away down in Albany, finishing off last Quokka's tour with Plaster of Paris, who are very sick. I'm going to play some of them in a second. But let me tell you what we've got on the show today. Later on, we will have some international headlines from around the internet that you might not have otherwise heard on Australian corporate media. But we've also got some chat about election fatigue and sort of the lack of substance in the election these days, and how it's very easy to tune out and kind of hard to get into, you know, all of the manufactured drama of it. What do you think of this election cycle, Kelly?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think a big one for me is just, I guess, what you're saying as well, with like it's very empty. Like,
yes,
it just feels like there's a lot of fluff about the personality types between ScoMo and Anthony Albanese, but not really a lot in the way of what they actually plan to do.
It's either kind of more of the same with Liberals, and then it's kind of really hard to pinpoint what Labor's actually bringing to the table.
I think you're right, and I think especially like for young people, like we did a segment not long ago just about the fact that there's not really a lot to be fussed over in terms of the budgets and things like that for young people, and especially around climate change and the environmental issues. It's all just very like underwhelming, I think.
Totally. And look, I love, you know, my political drama as much as the next chick. I was like watching the debates last night and everything, and, you know, like shouting at the screen and everything. But I don't know, like it's hard to put much stock in it because it doesn't really equal up to anything. Like, even if you look at the polls, it's like, well, last time the polls didn't mean anything. And you know, that's an ongoing problem. So it's like, I don't know. What game are they even playing?
I have no idea. It's crazy.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to election day because I'm having a party in my place.
Oh, that's so exciting.
You know,
election
watch the results
parties.
Come in. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Either you should cry or celebrate or both all at the one time.
Absolutely. Are you nauseated by this election campaign?
Yes.
Are you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Does the corporate media's banal coverage of it, replete with ridiculous gotcha moments and sports-like commentary on who is winning and losing, make you feel physically ill?
Yes.
Rest assured, you are not alone. In fact, it may well be you're in the majority. Indie Media's Alex Wisson had the opportunity to chat to someone who feels very much the same way. Dr. Dad Dr.
Dr. Dad.
Pardon me. Dr. Tad Tietzer is an author and political commentator. Tad started their conversation by addressing the question of whether or not he's paying close attention to the campaign, and if not, why not?
I've got to confess, I'm yet another victim of not paying that much close attention to this campaign. The last election campaign in 2019, I believe, I was actually living overseas for part of it, and I must say I was still more engaged back then. I think this phenomenon is to be expected, actually, because of the hollowness of what's going on. I mean, if you listen to some people, particularly people who like to do a lot of social media, you would think that this is an extremely important campaign. You know, it's life and death that Anthony Albanese defeats Scott Morrison and makes real change. But when you look at what the major parties and, in fact, the minor parties are offering, there's really a sense, a terrible sense of stasis in terms of what they're offering. They're offering such narrow platforms. There's really not even the pretense of them being visionary. I think it's incredible that if Albanese wins, as appears for the possible, you know, for the given the polls and so on, it's going to be the first time a Labor Party government has come into power in the post-war period without having kind of an agenda to come in on. It's really on the basis of we're this small target and ScoMo's really bad and vote for us.
Yeah, they seem to have, both political parties, major political parties, seem to have abandoned the notion of taking a mandate to the people, which historically has been very much a key part of election campaigns. The famous firebrand socialist Tad and one-time pin-up boy of the 1968 student movement in Britain, Tariq Ali, wrote a book a few years ago entitled The Extreme Centre. The central thesis of the work was the argument that since the triumph of the United States in the Cold War, Western politics more and more followed a path of what has come to be known as neoliberal orthodoxy. A lot of political water has obviously gone under the historical bridge during this period, but essentially I would agree with his argument that major political parties throughout the Western world are now first and foremost technocratic administrators of the capitalist system. There are no major ideological differences, no serious battles over policies and ideas. This is surely true of this particular campaign as well, aside from a few trimmings here and there, like Labor's commitment to Medicare funding for dental treatment, a bit more money for the NDIS and so on. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think the idea that they're technocrats has become less true over time, actually. I think there was an era of the technocrat, probably started in the 1980s, peaked with figures like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and finally Barack Obama. And then the final death knell, I think, of the technocrat was probably Emmanuel Macron, who appeared to be this technocrat who came out of nowhere, but in fact was forced to be intensely political. I think the real question is that the ideological differences no longer fall on the old lines that we really that dominated the world since quite early in the 20th century. I think the settlement after the First World War was that you increasingly saw all of politics divided up between left and right, where the left parties had a social base in, you know, some section of the trade unions or the working class, and the right-wing parties had, you know, some kind of social base around business and the middle class. All those connections to social bases, in fact, those social bases have really hollowed out. There aren't really the social institutions around which politics organises itself. And so for a period of time, I think the technocrat solution was there to say, well, we can rise above all this. We can just, you know, make decisions based on expertise and we'll take the politics out of it because the old left-right politics is dead. But I think we've seen instead an incredible resurgence of politics, just not on those old partisan lines. And if anything, the resurgence of politics has taken much more the form of there is the politics of the political elite, the political class, and how they increasingly have come to see the voters, the public, society at large as a kind of a problem and an impediment to be managed, and have increasingly, I think, come to see themselves as being lined up on one side of this divide. And, you know, if we can talk about the manifestations of it in terms of the controversies over the Brexit vote, where there was a narrow popular vote for Brexit against the wishes of the British political class. We can look at it in terms of the Trump vote, where, you know, Trump, even though he got a minority of votes, won the Electoral College. And suddenly the problem was seen, this group of voters who are upsetting the political class's ability to run things. But then I think the ultimate expression really comes in the COVID period, which I guess we should talk about at some point as well.
What you're talking about there reminds me of the Bertolt Brecht line about if people vote for the wrong government, the government should replace the people. And you've also touched on this very disturbing liberal notion of managed democracy. It's extraordinary how some liberals abandon any commitment to democracy when results don't go their way. Of course, one of the other trends in recent years in many Western countries has been the rise of a very heterogeneous series of what some people have called outsider parties, all of which have been loosely grouped under the rubric of populism. I'm referring here to everything from the Five Star Movement in Italy, Nigel Farage's UK Independence Party. You've already mentioned Trump and his extraordinary takeover of the Republican Party in the United States. And, of course, in Australia, everyone's favourite coal billionaire, Clive Palmer. This is a huge topic, tad worthy of a discussion spanning several hours. But first of all, definitionally speaking, why do you think such disparate parties are all lumped together under this rather ill-fitting term, populism? And what does that really mean? What's going on with it, with these sorts of parties and movements?
Yeah, look, I think really populism has been the term used, not just because some of these parties or political actors use sort of classic populist tropes, like talking about being either the representative or the personification of the people against the elite, because actually not all of these parties are like that. They don't all speak exactly the same language. There's a great variety in terms of what political agenda they actually push forward. But I think why the political class likes to think of them as populism is that the political class, as its social institutions that it used to organise around have decayed, actually starts to see the people as the problem. So therefore, in a sense, it's a useful hostile label to throw at them, even though they're so disparate. And really, the political class is kind of, and you know, media commentators and academics are trying to find a positive label for what is largely a negative phenomenon, the falling apart of support for the old sort of left-right political settlement.
Following on from the previous question, why has the voter backlash, the electoral revolt, whatever you want to call it, against neoliberal orthodoxy taken the form it has? Why have we seen this seemingly endless parade of, in many ways, clownish, ridiculous, almost comical figures like Farage, Palmer, Trump, Pauline Hanson and so on? I mean, say what you like about them, they're certainly more entertaining than drab grey individuals like Anthony Albanese and Scott Morrison. But why have we not seen any real political alternatives emerge, either from the left or right? And I'd ask you here to focus on Australia, in particular the lack of alternatives emerging during this campaign.
Well, look, I don't think it's just been these figures. I think it's important to look at Emmanuel Macron particularly, because he was seen as the saviour of the political elite, even though he was actually an outsider in many ways. He came in with a technocratic programme that fell apart pretty fast when he started to face resistance. He became increasingly anti-democratic in his focus. Sure, you can laugh about aspects of Macron. There are lots of aspects you can have a giggle about, but he's not a ridiculous or clownish figure in any sense, and was seriously seen. So I think there's been all kinds of different sort of alternatives have come out to fill the gap left by the collapse of support for the major parties. But I think ultimately the reason there isn't anything positive is there's no social basis for anything positive. Macron kind of was this figure who floated above the French political system, got popular support at the level of votes, had to cobble together a pseudo party to then run in the sort of the you know, elected representative elections, a party that itself has been weak and riddled with all kinds of problems. I think the issue is there is no social basis for some kind of new movement. Like there was, you know, in that early 20th century period where the rise of the labour movement, absolutely helped reshape politics, even if that meant that the labour movement was entirely encased in the political system as a result.
Coming back to Australia specifically, Tad, are there alternatives emerging? Perhaps I'm being too cynical about the lack of alternatives in this campaign.
No, I can't see any serious alternative. I think the issue is that all you're seeing is the negative aspect. So suddenly you've got these independents, the teal independents that are being talked about, and now people are becoming enthusiastic when they realise, temporarily enthusiastic once they realise how hollow Albanese is and how pathetic he is given how much time he's had to prepare for this. And they're investing some hopes in them in fixing the system, but they're not going to be capable of doing that either because they really don't have a social basis. Yes, they can pull votes on the basis of disillusionment with the major parties in various forms, particularly, I mean, I read this amazing article about the boganisation of the Liberal Party and the Teal candidate running against Josh Frydenberg and Ku Yong. And they're talking about, well, the Liberal Party, they've just become so boganised because they don't talk to us, wealthy upper-middle-class elites in Ku Yong anymore. So we need a progressive independent to talk to those people instead. So you see this kind of falling away of the old party's grip on things, but really you don't see anything substantial come in its way, I don't think.
And there's some strange sort of cultural factors and identity politics comes into that, but we'll perhaps get you on another time to discuss that aspect of things. But what is the COVID factor in this election, Tad? How has it impacted Australian politics and why is nobody talking about it anymore? And I should point out just on that, in preparing for this interview, we had a bit of a discussion about, what questions I would be asking. And you pointed out that I myself hadn't considered asking any COVID-related questions, which was really quite striking. But it does seem to me that nobody's talking about it, which is curious and strange. But what's the impact on Australian politics and why is nobody seemingly talking about COVID anymore?
Yeah, look, I think it's important to recognise that in the initial period, the COVID crisis and the panic around it, and then the sudden period of politicians, mainstream politicians, suddenly appearing to act and be decisive and to be doing stuff for the first time in ages, when for a very long time, as all this populist stuff was happening and so on, they appeared weaker and more confused and less decisive and so on. Here, suddenly, they were able to exercise what looked like an iron fist in, protecting the public, keeping the public safe and so on. And I think they rode that initial wave and you could see the results. There was a massive increase in the popularity and approval of most politicians, even ScoMo. Even Trump briefly at the beginning of that period saw a little bit of a bounce in his figures. But ScoMo had a huge boost in terms of the approval ratings. And you saw all political leaders with the benefit of incumbency who were tough and who acted on COVID did incredibly well. And you saw commentators like Catherine Murphy, who's one of the senior political commentators for The Guardian. She waxed lyrical about the National Cabinet. Suddenly, all the political woes that she was so worried about in the Australian system were just dissipating thanks to this newfound unity about keeping Australia locked down, the borders shut down, and so on. It was an incredible period, and I think we've seen most of that now dissipate. But I think the other thing that's really important is that no one really seems to know anything about it. It's almost like they want to make it go away. And I think it's really important to understand that what happened was, in the middle of that crisis year in early 2020, when the politicians acted, they were on top of the world. But at some point, it became politically unsustainable. And at the end of last year, you suddenly saw them moving incredibly quickly, well ahead of public opinion, towards opening the country up. They obviously saw political reasons why this was unsustainable. And we can always, try to blame Don Perrottet because he was a new president. premier. He came in, had something to prove. He was a bit of an anti-lockdowner himself. We can blame it all on him. But at exactly the same time, Dan Andrews followed suit as well. And you can see how the political class found that this new political settlement around locking people down, you know, controlling things, controlling borders, actually suddenly they decided wasn't useful to them anymore. They had to figure out how to get the hell out of it. And some of them have partly paid the price. I think probably ScoMo is one of them. If you look at that two-year period, ScoMo really just went along with the projects that the Labor and Liberal premiers were going on with the lockdowns. In fact, he was a pretty powerless character in some ways because the public health issues are largely governed by the states in terms of the way the Australian constitution is set up. So they all rode this wave of COVID lockdowns, and then when it all started to become politically unsustainable, they all got out, which is why they don't want to talk about it. Because you think about what is the central issue that is really bubbling up this election? It's actually the cost of living. Because people have really been squeezed, not just by the 2 years they got squeezed over COVID, but of course some people are able to save money if they're in a lucky position with an ongoing job and so on. But now we have a situation where inflation has gone up. Part of the reason there's inflation is because of supply chain problems, because of the disruptions of the world's trade system. Partly, you know, it's the huge amounts of money that not just the government, but more disturbingly, the balance sheet of the Reserve Bank of Australia, it's crazy. They've just released a graph the other day to show how much they blew on managing this crisis. And it is historically unprecedented amount of money being poured into the economy to keep the economy afloat in terms of what the Reserve Bank was doing. So there's all these things that have come out of that period that no one actually really wants to talk about it that way, because of course to them, you know, we managed the public health crisis and it's all very good, but actually the chickens are coming home to roost now. So it's this undercurrent that doesn't express itself, because I think most people thought something had to be done about public health issues, even though perhaps people like me who are opposed to lockdowns thought it was irrational and ultimately was going to cause more destruction than good. But lots of people, you know, thought it was an important thing to keep Australia safe, to take tough measures and so on. But now that we're coming out of it, the chickens have come home to roost, and I think that's what's, you know, behind stuff in the election. But then when you look at the main parties, is there really that much of a difference between how they're going to deal with the cost of living crisis? Actually, neither of them really have answers. No party's got answers to this crisis. And I think that's really where we're at. It's going to be an election that might change government, but whichever side comes in is really going to face tremendous political pressures.
That was commentator, political analyst and author Dr. Tad Tietzer speaking to Indie Media's Alex Wisson with his thoughts on the federal election campaign and the wider political context in which it's taking place. You are listening to RTRFM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show. You are listening to the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM. You are with me, Joni Boyd, and
Kelly Warden.
Hell yeah. The Kelly Warden. The Warden of Kellys. You're watching over all of those Kellys.
I do that.
good day to the bloke who just called up saying he enjoyed the political chat earlier. And sorry, I should have put a language warning before that track. It very much belongs on the station. It's very much within our remit. But especially this time of day, I should be putting language warning before a track. I once messed up very badly. There was a song with lots of C words in
it. Goodness.
And I was a bit too excited to play it. But for now, we are going to have some international news headlines. A lot of these are sourced from Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera. The World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic caused the deaths of nearly 15 million people worldwide through the end of last year. The WHO's estimate is nearly triple the 5.4 million deaths reported by governments. It's based on an examination of the number of excess deaths, that is, how many more people died than would otherwise be expected. The majority of these deaths occurred in Southeast Asia, followed by Europe and the Americas. In southern Ukraine, Russia's military has reportedly launched a ground assault on the last holdout of Ukrainian forces in the besieged city of Mariupol. New video shows explosions at the vast Avostal steelworks plant, where Ukrainian fighters say some 200 civilians remain sheltered from the fighting. The UN says it has dispatched another convoy to Mariupol in its latest effort to evacuate more civilians. Meanwhile, the World Food Programme is appealing to Russia to reopen Ukraine's ports on the Black Sea to allow for shipments of grain. Speaking to a UN donors conference in Warsaw, Poland on Thursday, WFP director and Nobel Peace Laureate David Beasley said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has pushed global food prices to near record highs, raising the cost of commodities like wheat, corn and cooking oil. Furthermore, related to this crisis, Africa faces an unprecedented crisis caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine that has led to soaring food and fuel prices, the United Nations said. The conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Moscow are disrupting supplies of wheat, fertilizer and other goods, compounding the difficulties Africa already faces from climate change and the coronavirus pandemic. A widespread surge in inflation poses risks, particularly to South Africa, Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone. Many African countries depend heavily on food imports and fertilizer from Russia and Ukraine, two major exporters of wheat, corn, rapeseed and sunflower oil. In some African countries, up to 80% of wheat came from Russia and Ukraine. And also related, Nigerian airlines are to suspend all domestic flights from Monday over a fourfold increase in jet fuel prices, an umbrella organization of operators said on Saturday. The rise in jet fuel prices is primarily caused due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And in Mexico, police freed 280 asylum seekers locked inside a tractor trailer that was abandoned Friday on a roadside in the southern state of Veracruz. A Red Cross worker said the migrants were lucky to be alive after local residents responded to their pleas for help. The 280 asylum seekers came from Cuba, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Ecuador, Guatemala and Honduras. Among them were 18 children. They were apprehended by Mexico's National Migration Institute, which will determine their status. Meanwhile, Mexican authorities have reportedly agreed to take back more Cuban and Nicaraguan migrants expelled by the United States under Title 42, a Trump-era public health order that has been used to block nearly 2 million people arriving in the U.S.-Mexico border from seeking asylum, a violation of international law. In Iraq, at least one person died and more than 5,000 were hospitalized with respiratory ailments Thursday as a massive dust storm blanketed much of the country. Six of Iraq's 18 provinces suffered the storm's effects, including the capital, Baghdad, where authorities urged everyone to stay indoors, especially those with breathing difficulties. It's the seventh severe dust storm to hit Iraq in just the last month. In March, the International Monetary Fund released a report finding temperatures in the Middle East and Central Asia have already risen 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, triggering droughts and causing over 2,600 deaths a year. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has issued yet another decree imposing further restrictions on Afghan women and criminalizing their clothing. While the Taliban have always imposed restrictions to govern the bodies of Afghan women, the decree is the first for this regime where criminal punishment is assigned for violation of the dress code for women. The Taliban's recently reinstated Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice announced on Saturday that it is required for all respectable Afghan women to wear a hijab or headscarf. If a woman is caught without a hijab, her mahram, a male guardian, will be warned. The second time, the guardian will be summoned by Taliban officials, and after repeated summons, her guardian will be imprisoned for 3 days, according to the statement.
Thank you, Kelly. And that's all the headlines we've got this week. Yeah, you are listening to RTRFM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show, your weekly dose of activist news from grassroots orgs and stuff like that. We will be back next Monday from the time of 11 a.m. And you're lining up something this afternoon for next Monday. What have you got for us?
We have a very interesting interview with the CEO of Native Title Council. Council Australia, Jamie Lowe.
Lovely.
Yeah, so that should be good. We're going to be having a chat kind of off the back of the Aboriginal Press Club event that was last week, Thursday. And yeah, I guess the conversation was kind of revolving around mining and native title and the impact on communities, and I guess also sort of discussing some of the opportunities for economic benefit as a result of the mining.
Economic benefits, in kind of scare quotes.
Quote unquote, yep. Economic benefits, but you know, with the degradation of land on top of that. So yep. I don't know, very interesting conversations coming out of that. And,
yeah, you said you went along and there was a lot of, you know, the big mining companies setting the agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. It was sponsored by BHP, I think.
There you go.
And yeah. So there was definitely, yeah, it's definitely just a space that I've never really been in before, actually, and like listening to these kind of different views, on mining. And so, yeah, it was just quite interesting to have Jamie come in and just sort of shed some light on his thoughts on, yeah, I guess the future of mining in Australia and what needs to change.
Lovely. Something to look forward to for next week. I believe we will have Ray and Brahma back in the studio. I might be here, I might not. See how we go.